Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Coast's Toronto affiliate, In-Depth Radio News Talk 1010. November 11th is Veterans Day in the United States. Here in Canada, we call it Remembrance Day. In Canada, we wear red poppies on our lapels, or some of us do, less and less of us each year, it seems. The poppy is a well-known and well-established symbol here, one that carries with it a wealth of history and meaning. It's an artificial flower that we wear, and it's been used since 1921 to commemorate military personnel who have died during war. The creation of the Remembrance Poppy was inspired by the poem In Flanders Fields, which was written during World War I by Canadian Lieutenant Colonel, we say Lieutenant, you say Lieutenant, Canadian Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae, who was a poet, a physician, an author, an artist, and a soldier during World War I. He wrote, "In Flanders fields the poppies blow, between the crosses row on row that mark our place. And in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields." To all veterans in and current members of the United States and Canadian Armed Services, I salute you and I thank you for your service. Coming up in the second half, retired U.S. Army Major General Dana J.H. Pittard will join us to discuss his pivotal role in the initial U.S. response to halt the aggressive spread of ISIS in Iraq. He's the co-author of a new book called Hunting the Caliphate, and details this remarkable operation. It's a vivid first-person narrative. A Special Operations Joint Terminal Attack Controller and his commanding general give fascinating and detailed accounts of America's fight against one of the most barbaric insurgencies the world has ever seen. But first, with Washington, D.C. preoccupied with investigations of first Russian collusion and now Ukrainian collusion and accusations of fake news, rigged elections, and a deep state shadow government, the notion of conspiracies has never been more mainstream. In his book, American Conspiracies and Cover-Ups, Douglas Sirignano has compiled an impressive collection of exclusive interviews with the brightest experts in alternative history to create the definitive guide to our country's biggest secrets. Among the conspiracy luminaries Sirignano spoke with for the book, the late New York Times best-selling author Jim Mars on the deep state and New World Order, MIT professor Noam Chomsky on mainstream media controlled by big business and government, Martin Luther King associate Dr. William F. Pepper on the U.S. government's participation in the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., election reform activist Bev Harris on whether voting machines can be trusted, and leading experts on the JFK assassination, 9/11, Pearl Harbor, vaccinations, AIDS, income tax, the Federal Reserve, terrorism, and more. It's a soup to nuts on conspiracy theory. My conversation with Douglas Sirignano is next. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Interviewer and author Douglas Sirignano's work has appeared on Alex Jones, Infowars.com, PrisonPlanet.com, Disinformation.com, American Conspiracies and Cover-Ups, JFK, 9/11, the Feds, rigged elections, suppressed cancer cures, and the great conspiracies of our time is Douglas's new work. Douglas, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Oh, very good. Nice to talk to you again, Richard. Thanks for arranging this. Nice to be here.
Likewise. So we are approaching, hard to believe, the 56th anniversary of the assassination of JFK, and that certainly remains sort of the granddaddy of all conspiracies for all of us, I think, here in North America.
Yes. But
and your choice for an interview on this one is quite interesting. You chose to interview LBJ's attorney, Barr McClellan, to talk about the Kennedy assassination. First of all, explain a little bit about who Barr McClellan was, or rather was to LBJ, and who he is, and then we'll find out why you chose to spoke with him.
Well, he was one of LBJ's lawyers. He worked for the law firm of a guy named Edward Clark, who was the most powerful lawyer in Texas, and he was LBJ's real close confidant, Edward Clark, and mentor, the political boss of Texas, really, Edward Clark. And McClellan worked for that law firm, and so he had inside information about the JFK assassination, and he wrote a book about it. What it came back about 2000. And actually, his son was also the head of the FDA, and his other son was Scott McClellan. He was George Bush Jr.'s press secretary, but he was one of LBJ's lawyers.
Now, you asked him a rather interesting question, and it had to do with the law firm that McClellan worked with, and they were very concerned about Johnson after he left the White House. In fact, I think between 1971 and 73, LBJ was seeing a psychiatrist. Talk to me about that and why the law firm was so concerned about this.
Well, they say, you know, after he left the White House, LBJ had a real life-threatening depression. He was really depressed. And according to Barr McClellan, LBJ and Edward Clark might have been involved with a number of murders. And so maybe this is according to what Barr McClellan says. Other people believe it also. Texas was a rough place. You know, if you had a political enemy in Texas, you know, they used the gun down there. I mean, not everybody, but it was done down there. And so he was in a bad depression after he left the White House. And the law firm, I think they were worried that he was going to confess to the psychiatrist that he had engaged in murders, maybe even in the murder of JFK. And so they asked Barr McClellan to write some type of paper on how they could prevent the psychiatrist from letting loose whatever LBJ was going to confess to him.
And did Barr McClellan, or does Barr McClellan, believe that it's possible that LBJ confessed to his psychiatrist about his role in the JFK assassination?
Yes, I would say, yeah, he thinks that's a possibility. Yes, yes.
You also talked to Barr McClellan about Billy Saul Estes, who was this corrupt Texas businessman who had dealings with LBJ. Explain that connection and why a Senate investigation of Billy Saul Estes could also have sent LBJ to jail.
Yeah, Billy Saul Estes, he was a cotton farmer, and he was a close friend of LBJ, and apparently LBJ was doing something allowing him to get more cotton allotments. I think that's the amount of cotton you're allowed to grow down in Texas, and he got more than was legally allowed, and LBJ was arranging that in all likelihood. And so he went to prison for that, and then he got out of prison in 1984, I believe, and he basically told the grand jury, Billy Saul Estes, that LBJ had helped to kill Kennedy, and the grand jury believed him. And if LBJ had been alive then, he would have been arrested for conspiracy to murder. And if that trial had happened, you know, when Kennedy was president, then LBJ obviously would have been convicted then. But then after Kennedy was killed, then LBJ was obviously able to block the investigation because he was the president.
But weren't there also Senate investigations of Billy Saul Estes prior that had LBJ not been president, or had he not been in the White House, he may have ended up going to jail.
Yes.
In other words, if he wasn't president because of the assassination, he would have gone to jail.
Yes, that's right. Because they were investigating him before Kennedy was assassinated, and then they had to stop that for some reason. Then Kennedy was assassinated, and LBJ was able to block the investigation into Billy Sol Estes. And so, also a guy named Bobby Baker was a very corrupt businessman who LBJ had relations with, and he might have went to prison because of his relations with him, too, if Kennedy hadn't been killed.
So therein lies a possible motive. If LBJ doesn't rise to the presidency, then he could have been indicted, charged, and jailed.
Yes, yes. Also, there might have been Kennedy was going to drop him as vice president running mate, his running mate. He might have, and that might have been another motivation.
And what did Barr McClellan make of Madeleine Duncan Brown? We should take a moment here and explain, you know, that she was LBJ's mistress. And she had some rather startling allegations that she revealed about LBJ, I think the night before Kennedy's assassination. Just explain what that was.
Oh, yeah. She said the night before Kennedy's assassination, Johnson was meeting with some powerful oil men down there in Dallas. And he came out of the meeting. Madeleine Brown was at the house. He walked over to Madeleine Brown and he said, after tomorrow, those goddamn Kennedys are never going to embarrass me again. That's not a threat. That's a promise. This was the day before the assassination. And you could go to YouTube now and you could see videos of Madeleine Brown claiming that LBJ had a foreknowledge of the assassination. That's what she said. Barr McClellan says he doesn't know if she's credible or not. But he knows some people think she's credible, but it doesn't matter because there's already so much evidence that points to LBJ as the killer of JFK.
And what about for you, Douglas? Do you think that Madeleine Duncan Brown was credible?
I think she was. I got a feeling she was because you can watch on YouTube, and she's talking about the LBJ had foreknowledge. You know, Roger Stone just wrote a book about that, the guy who's Donald Trump's associate, and he believes she was credible, and his whole book was about, you know, that the evidence that LBJ killed JFK.
Right. I think LBJ may have been let in on the plot, but I think those that ordered it, carried it out, were high above even Johnson's pay grade.
I agree with you. I think you're right.
All right. I want to move on to William Francis Pepper. And I had an opportunity several years ago. I met with William in New York, and we had a great conversation for a TV episode I was producing at the time. And Pepper, of course, is an attorney. And talk to me about his association with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Oh, yeah. About a year before King was assassinated, he saw an article that Pepper wrote in some magazine about all the evidence that the bombings, the U.S. bombings, were killing and maiming Vietnamese children. So he wanted to meet Pepper, and he did about a year before he was killed to talk about that. And then he became Pepper and him became very close friends in the last year of his life. When Dr. King ran for president in 1968 at that convention, he asked Dr. Pepper to introduce him at the convention. Then Pepper was one of King's pallbearers at his funeral. And he was actually the guy who inspired Martin Luther King to begin protesting the Vietnam War. And he feels that was probably the main reason that he was killed.
Does he feel guilty about that because he was sort of the one that got King in more politicized and involved?
Yeah, he did have some guilt about it. He did. I asked him about that. Yeah. I asked him, are you proud that you were the one who inspired Dr. King to protest the Vietnam War? And he said, no, you know, actually, I'm very sad about it, you know. And he felt a bit of guilt. And more than anything, I think he felt sadness.
And Pepper would go on to defend James Earl Ray, the supposed gunman. And he met Ray in prison in 1978, along with Dr. King's associate, the Reverend Ralph Abernathy. What were Pepper's initial feelings about James Earl Ray?
Oh, he felt that there's no way he could have been the assassin, because he said the first time he met him, he interrogated him for 5 hours with Ralph Abernathy and also a body language expert from Harvard. And all three of them felt there's no way this guy did it. He said James Earl Ray was a very peaceful, docile, quiet man. And he did not have the personality of an assassin. And Pepper felt there's no way that he did it.
And the name Lloyd Jowers came up in your conversation, and Jowers would later be named as a co-conspirator in the civil trial, and William Pepper was representing the King family, and this was decades after the King after MLK's assassination. I think it took place in the 90s.
1999.
And Pepper won that case. The I think the jury ruled. In mere moments, didn't they?
About an hour, yeah.
Yeah.
And, Lord Jowers, he was a Memphis resident, and he had connections to corrupt policemen and corrupt mafia guys who apparently were behind the assassination, also probably being influenced by United States intelligence. And so at the trial, the jury ended up concluding that Lloyd Jowers participated in a conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King and also the United States government. This is what the jury concluded because Pepper had the testimony of some Army intelligence guys who said they were there that day to kill Dr. King.
Right. And again, this is a civil trial, not a criminal trial. But in the civil trial, the jury essentially then exonerated James Earl Ray.
Yes, they did. Yeah.
But Pepper didn't believe that Jowers actually fired the shot, correct?
Correct. That's right, yeah. He said, I asked him, do you know who fired the shot? Because Jowers owned a restaurant right behind the Lorraine Motel where Dr. King was killed. And so that's probably the reason they used him, because somebody apparently was in there's some bushes behind the restaurant, and they probably shot him from there. I asked him who shot, and he said, that'll be in my next book. So if you want to get his last book, you could see who shot. And then apparently Jowers took the rifle from the guy and then hid it in his restaurant, because a woman who knew Jowers, she walked into his restaurant at 6 o'clock on April 4th, 1968, when Dr. King was killed. And she saw Jowers walk right after she heard a loud gunshot. She saw Jowers walk into his restaurant and hide the gun. This is what she testified to.
And there were a number of witnesses that saw the shooter who fired the fatal shot behind the bushes in the adjacent to the parking lot.
Yeah, there were a number of people who saw somebody back there. I think there was a reporter from the New York Times, also Dr. King's chauffeur. I don't know if they – but also there was an Army photographer – no, an FBI or Army photographer. They took a picture of a guy with a rifle back there. They actually had the picture of it. And the other guys felt that they saw somebody back there, but they didn't know if it was the shooter, but it was suspicious that there was somebody back there. But an Army photographer, FBI photographer, they actually caught a picture of it, but of course that wasn't released by the government.
And then what did Pepper tell you about the crime scene and what happened to those bushes?
Yeah, there was a bunch of bushes there. Now, let me remember now. There are bushes there. They cut down the bushes because then it right on the next day, the next morning, there was a bunch of bushes there that would have concealed the guy taking the shot. And they were cut down the next morning so that it would look like there was no bushes there to hide a shooter. And, yeah, they were cut down the next morning to make it appear that there's no way somebody could take a shot from there.
In other words, they were tampering with the crime scene.
Yes. Yeah, that's in my interview with William Pepper, and he's a lawyer, so he knows what's important and what's not about these things.
All right. We'll take a quick time out, and then we'll return on the other side. Douglas Sirignano, interviewer, author, American Conspiracies and Cover-Ups, and we'll open up the phone lines, at the top of the hour, take questions and comments. And now, taking us into the break, Matthew Sweet, born in Lincoln, Nebraska, and then attended college in Athens, Georgia, where he became part of that burgeoning music scene there that spawned such bands as REM and the B-52s. The song is called Girlfriend. Back with more on Coast to Coast AM. Douglas Sirigdano is with us, the author of American Conspiracies and Cover-Ups. Douglas, it seems to me right now we're experiencing this paradox where, at least for the public, conspiracy has never been more, I don't know, mainstream, or they've never been more, the public has never been more accepting of conspiracies. And yet the term conspiracy or conspiracy theory has never been more radioactive. Particularly by, you know, institutions and government agencies. I read recently there was a federal agency that was urging the intelligence groups to consider conspiracy theorists akin to domestic terrorists. So this paradox, you know, the public is more interested in conspiracies, they're more accepting, and then it's so radioactive. What do you think is going on?
That's a good question. You know, I think one of the reasons that conspiracy theory, the term, is so pejorative and has a negative connotation is, from what I understand, right after the Kennedy assassination, the CIA had a specific program to use their influence in whatever media outlets, and they had a lot of influence in the media, to make the term conspiracy theory pejorative, make it a negative connotation, because the CIA apparently wanted everybody to believe the Warren Commission. This was written by, a book was written about that called Conspiracy Theory in America by an author named DeHaven Smith. And he said it was very successful. Ever since then, the term conspiracy theory has a negative connotation. He said it was a very successful initiative by the CIA. But I think it's becoming more accepted among the mainstream, I think because of the internet, you know. So much of this information has come out over the internet, and it's grown. I guess the internet, what, started in the early 90s? Grown. And I think that might be the reason that so many people are interested in it, but we still have to fight the influence of that CIA initiative that made it such a pejorative term.
Well, it goes without saying that, you know, some conspiracy theories are true. There, you know, there are conspiracies. There are, you know, tens of thousands probably of criminal conspiracy charges that are adjudicated in courts every year, but do you think there is a danger with conspiracy theories in that they tend to undermine our trust in institutions? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think they keep the institutions honest, in my opinion. I think that, you know, it's the very nature of militaries and intelligence agencies to act in covert, secretive ways. So to assume that there aren't conspiracies going on is ridiculous. And I guess since I wrote this book, you know, I'm probably one who thinks that there are conspiracies. And so I don't think that it undermines institutions. I think it's helps us get closer to the truth.
Earlier you mentioned the intelligence and the control over the media, and I know that you sat down with, or over the phone, you spoke with Noam Chomsky from MIT about the corporate media, and you talked to him about that very subject, the CIA controlling or manipulating the media.
Yeah.
Talk to us about the Senate, the Church Committee back in 75, which investigated this very topic.
Yes, the CIA's connection to the media, and it really concluded that the CIA had a lot of influence over the media. I think I got a quote here. It said, one journalist who reviewed the Church Committee, it said, it proved the CIA owned or financed dozens of newspapers and news organizations, had close relations with some of the most powerful men in the media and with more than 400 journalists. And then another journalist said the CIA can spread propaganda and disinformation just about anywhere and anytime it wants. So I think that committee really, and there was a specific program that the CIA had, Project Mockingbird, to do just that, to influence the media. So I think they still have a lot of influence over the media, and what they found out with the Church Committee back then is still true today, in my opinion.
Right, and you also point out that at the time the CIA head director was Colby, and I guess there was some cooperation from him, and then he was replaced by George Herbert Walker Bush as CIA chief. And what did he do with the Church Committee?
I think he pretty much stonewalled it. You know, he said, "Oh yeah, maybe we have a little influence here and there, but it's not much." And he didn't give over much information. And then Colby died suspiciously, didn't he? So maybe they were replacing Colby with a guy who was really going to keep the lid on the CIA's connections to the media.
I believe Colby supposedly drowned in the Potomac River. All right, was basically ruled a kayaking or canoeing misadventure or something like that.
No, we're laughing.
So, Chomsky, what did he make of perhaps even a continuance in the CIA's influence over the media? Does he believe that?
He basically told me that he thinks that it has some influence, but it's not this overarching influence that some people believe, especially some people who read about the Church Committee investigations. He believes it has some influence. But then Chomsky is not a guy who believes in conspiracy theories. He probably doesn't believe that the deep state has that much influence and whatnot. So it doesn't surprise me that he would say that.
Which is interesting because Chomsky is often quoted and held up as just that, you know, by many conspiracy theorists. They always seem to be quoting Chomsky. So is he sort of annoyed that he's become, the poster boy for conspiracies?
Oh, yeah, I think he might be. He doesn't really believe. He says there's some conspiracies, but a lot of those conspiracies that people believe in are inaccurate, or they're going overboard or something. I remember once Alex Jones talked to him on his show, and then Alex Jones was getting impatient with him because he felt he was actually covering up things for the New World Order, Noam Chomsky. And at the end, when he hung up, Alex Jones said to him, "Go say hi to David Rockefeller." I don't know, maybe he's going a little overboard there. I think Chomsky, I don't know, man, I don't know if he's consciously and deliberately covering things up, but he just doesn't accept a lot of conspiracy theories.
But he does share your concern, I'm guessing, with the and a lot of people's concern with the concentration of media ownership in the United States. Something like, I believe the quote, the figure you quoted is six corporations control, is it 95% of the radio, TV, and newspaper outlets?
Yeah, something like that. And so that's where he feels that the media is being corrupted, because it's owned by the big corporations. So it's just going to protect the interests of the big corporations, and that's what the media is to him. He doesn't think it's a CIA or a Council on Foreign Relations conspiracy, although other people think that. It's just a matter of the corporations control it, and they're going to control it in a way that favors the corporations.
And so how do you see this control happening with these media corporations? You have these six guys all getting together, or six men presumably, all sitting in a room at the same time, determining what the news is and what the public's going to see and hear and believe? Is that how it works, do you think?
Well, I guess that's a possibility. I think maybe it's more, it comes from the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a secretive think tank started by the Rockefellers, and it's one of the think tanks that want to have globalization, a new world order. So many of the media outlets are controlled by people who belong to the Council on Foreign Relations. So in my opinion, I think maybe the control is coming from there. I don't know if it's six guys, but it's coming from this Council on Foreign Relations, I think.
So when you put this book together, and I believe there are 12 individuals that you finally decided to interview, and as you know, we've talked about JFK, we talked about MLK, How did you sort of settle on those 12 interviews? For example, were there people that you really wanted to talk to, and they shut you down? They weren't interested?
No, you know, I sort of lucked out. It was like I really feel lucky and grateful that I got just about everybody I wanted to interview, and it was I lucked out. I got, you know, some of the biggest conspiracy theory authors in the world. I don't know. I think the 12 conspiracies that I talk about in my book, I think maybe the, in my mind, they're maybe like the main conspiracies that people believe in. Or I think I cover, you can cover like the main conspiracy viewpoints of the conspiracy theory people in about 12 interviews. Maybe I missed a few things here and there, but I think they were the 12 main and most important ones in my mind.
Well, one of the interviews was with a researcher, cancer researcher, Dr. Ralph Moss, and you talked to him about alternative treatments for cancer, and this is one of those, you know, I would say widely held beliefs that there is a cancer cure out there that is being actively suppressed, or a cancer treatment. Now, tell us who Dr. Ralph Moss is. Tell us a little bit more about him and why you decided to speak to him about this.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's considered maybe the leading authority on alternative treatments for cancer. And he actually worked at Memorial Sloan Kettering back in the 70s, which is the most important cancer hospital in the world. It's in New York City. And at the time, this very respected researcher found that Laetril, which is vitamin B12, can help eradicate cancer. But the Sloan Memorial, they covered that up. They didn't admit that. And Ralph Moss saw this, and so he wrote another report saying that they're not telling the truth. Vitamin B12 can help with cancer, and he was fired because of that. And then he became like a big critic of the cancer establishment. But he's gotten so much flack over the years that I think he's hesitant to criticize the pharmaceutical industry, because the pharmaceutical industry is very, very powerful, and they can come at you in a million different ways. But, you know, he still thinks, you know, chemotherapy might not be the best thing, and there are other good ways to treat cancer. But I think he's more silent about it these days. I think he got a lot of flack.
Well, I guess that was my earlier point, an earlier question about whether, you know, some of these people, they did seem somewhat guarded in the excerpts, for example, that I read. For example, Dr. Ralph Moss seemed guarded in his answers. He didn't want to come out and say that there are treatments that are being suppressed. Did you find that?
Yeah, that's, well, because I think he says that some people who advocate alternative treatments for cancer, they will exaggerate, and I think that's true. Say somebody takes some vitamin and it cures them of cancer. That doesn't mean it's going to cure everybody. It might work for some people. So he says people exaggerate, and so that's why he's hesitant, and he might be right in that way. But there are certainly some treatments besides, if you have a cancer that chemotherapy or radiation can't cure, there are other ways to go. There are other things to try, and they could help you and even cure you. But nothing is 100% a cure. And I think that's why Moss is hesitant to, like, dive too much into the advocating alternative treatments.
You were really pressing him on vitamin C, massive doses of vitamin C as a potential cure for cancer. You cited Dr. Linus Pauling, of course, the only person to ever win two Nobel Prizes, unshared Nobel Prizes, and he believed this.
Yes.
Why vitamin C? Why were you honing in on that? Is this kind of is this a personal story?
No, because I think Dr. Linus Pauling, he won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, and he won the Nobel Peace Prize also. He's politically active. So that seems like a very credible source, and he claimed mega doses of vitamin C could help, and in some cases cure cancer. And so, but he got no cooperation, and he became totally frustrated with the cancer establishment because they didn't cooperate with him. And he won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, and he eventually said everyone should know that the war on cancer is a fraud. So I figured I was talking, stressing that with Moss because, you know, Dr. Linus Pauling is such a credible source, you know.
And again, what was Moss's impression of Dr. Linus Pauling and his claims about vitamin C?
Oh, he thought Pauling was a great man and an honest man, but what he says is just because it works for some people doesn't mean it's going to work for everybody. And his main point is you can't exaggerate about these things, you know. He says, yeah, vitamin C could be, but you need clinical trials to prove it. And I think he's right about that. But some people have been cured of cancer by taking multi-doses of vitamin C.
Right. It's hard to do clinical trials, to raise money to do clinical trials on, you know, something that's already out there in the public domain.
Yeah, that's what he says is the main problem. Because to get a cancer treatment approved costs $250 million. Nobody's going to pay for that unless they can get the patent on the cure. Nobody's going to pay $250 million to test vitamin C, because if it was proved that it could cure cancer, they couldn't have the patent, because vitamin C comes from nature, so you can't patent it. So all
right.
The natural good treatments come from nature, They can't be patented, so nobody's going to pay to get that approved as an official treatment for cancer. That was Moss's main point.
And how about for you? Do you sincerely believe that there is a cure out there that has been actively suppressed?
I think there are positive treatments that have been actively suppressed. Yeah, I do. And I think nothing is 100% going to cure everybody, but there are certain treatments that could help people. And, yeah, I think it happens. I think there's a good book about that called Politics and Healing by a writer called Daniel Haley, and he cited so many instances in which a doctor had a good cure, a good treatment for cancer. Some of the patients were getting better. Some of the patients were being cured. Maybe it didn't work for some people, but FDA came in and suppressed the treatment and shut them down. So I think maybe, you know, if there's a Illuminati, if there's a deep state controlling everything, maybe they want to they're making too much money selling chemotherapy. Maybe they want us all sick so they can push us all into Big Brother concentration camps.
Well, you sort of wrapped up a bunch of conspiracies all in one big ball there. Listen, we're gonna talk about the deep state. You had a chance to meet with the late great Jim Mars, New York Times best-selling author, and we'll talk about that conversation on the other side. Taking us into the break, Margaret Glaspie, Emotions and Math, right here on Coast to Coast AM.